Live from Chicago, this is Beyond the Beltway. My name is Chris Roebling, and I am sitting in for Bruce Dumont, taking a well-deserved night off. This is our analysis of national politics featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, political cartoonists, public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast and border to border. Joining us tonight, Democrat activist Sarah Beardsley, Republican Joe Morris, and Scott Stantis, the political cartoonist of the Chicago Tribune. This program is coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in beautiful downtown Chicago, where our toll-free phones are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. And our website is www.beyondthebeltway.com. Welcome, panel. Thanks for coming. Welcome, viewers, listeners, watchers, wherever you are and however you're connecting with us. We're on so many different platforms that, you know, I had a full head of heroin the first time I saw the list, but now no longer. Thanks for coming in tonight. Big story. I think we want to talk about 2015 in our first hour tonight and 2016 in our second. And I asked all of you to come up with some lists of the biggest stories of 15 and predictions for 16. But let's just talk right off the bat about Donald Trump and his continued domination of the Republican march towards the actual voting by regular Americans. We've now got a new poll out, a CNN poll. It is the latest national poll in which he is leading the pack very substantially. He's up in the 38-39% territory. And then you've got Ted Cruz about 18-19%. And behind Ted Cruz, there's Marco Rubio and Ben Carson, both at about 10. And everybody else is down into single digits. Joe Morris, you're our Republican tonight. What explains the longevity of the lead of Donald Trump?
Well, I think it's two things. One is the decay of the American body politic. There's a disease that we saw rise to the top in 2008 with the candidacy of Barack Obama. I think Donald Trump is in many respects a Republican version of Barack Obama. I don't mean that in the sense of the particular issues that animates him, but a really important fundamental style. This is an individual who is arrogant, he is ignorant, he is supremely narcissistic, and comes to the game with a very little fund, a very small fund of policy issues about which he's seriously informed and seriously cares. He is more about nuance and kind of a frothy sense of, postulating an appeal for change and hope. If you've heard that slogan before, it may sound familiar. That is, he is an inkblot, a Rorschach test in the eyes of believers. You can see in him what you want. He gives voice to your irritations and annoyances. If you're annoyed with the mainstream media, if you're annoyed with political correctness, Donald Trump is bleating at the top of his lungs something that says he feels your pain.
Sarah Beardsley, our Democrat, do you agree with Joe Morris that Donald Trump is a Republican 2015-16 version of 2007-08 Barack Obama?
The very first time, Joe, I've ever heard anyone call Donald Trump nuanced. So that's a first for me. I would not have drawn the comparison between Obama and Trump. I understand the narrow nature of the issues that may have been at the top of Obama's area of concern when he was running, and his relative newcomer status to politics, although he was elected to two different offices in our state. I think Donald Trump's an American. I think the things he said are just virulently anti-American and go against everything that most people in this country really stand for. How to explain his standing is, I think, it's fairly early. We'll see what happens in February. I know we're getting close. And the people who will vote may not be the people who are paying the most attention. He makes good copy, right, Scott?
Sure.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
So
all right.
That's a big part of what I see is going on with Trump is the media loves him because there's always something to talk about because everything he says being so incredibly off the wall.
Well, both of you have said a lot that we can unpack in future minutes. But Scott Stantis, what's your explanation for Trump's seeming domination.
I can tell you, amongst editorial cartoonists, he's pulling it like 100%. Please, please win. Just the hair, just because it's so fun to draw that guy. He really is a remarkable candidate. We've never seen anything quite like him in our lifetimes. I mean, there are other comparisons. I think you can look at a Howard Dean, for instance. If you recall, he was polling huge numbers before and then comes in third in Iowa. I think, indeed, we have to look at the story and the votes. Do these polls translate into votes? Chris, you're a political. You've worked in politics your whole life. I mean, have you seen anything like this, A? And B, does this translate into votes in February? I mean, caucus states, I think that's problematic. I think Iowa, you're going to see Cruz will probably win there, to tell you the truth. And that's the kind of candidate that wins in Iowa. You know, we've had Huckabees, Santorums, Robertsons. We've had that type. But when it gets to New Hampshire, when it gets down to South Carolina?
Well, I want to keep, as much as possible, I want to keep 16 in the second hour of the program. So
okay, I'm sorry.
Let's stick with that.
But I want to
get to why haven't any of the other Republican candidates been able to pierce this Trump balloon?
Because I think the point about the mainstream media is correct. Trump is sucking the air out of the room for all those other candidates. And there is a logic to that from the point of view of many who are commenting on it, which is exactly, I agree, he's un-American, he's a troglodyte, he's ugly, his views are worrisome. He is, in other words, an anti-Republican cartoonist's dream of a caricature of the Republican Party. Anything nasty that you want to see in the Republican Party, you see in Donald Trump. If I were designing a candidacy that was aimed at destroying the Republican Party for a generation, poisoning the well, making the Republican Party be identified with xenophobic, bigoted, know-nothing views, I would design the candidacy of Donald Trump. And I think the enemies of the Republican Party, who are legion in the media, see exactly that opening with his personality and have a vested interest in keeping him front and center.
I think, too, there's something that we're not commenting on. It's very basic. People know him. He's been in their TV screens for a decade now. He's a personality that everybody knows. Couple that with the idea that you have a group of Republican candidates who are tremendous. This is a very deep bench, maybe the deepest I've seen in my lifetime,
but
truly.
Colorless by comparison.
Colorless by comparison, but you talk about candidates who care deeply about issues, have a deep understanding, and that pales by comparison of someone who calls you a pottyhead.
Now, Sarah, did you expect more from the Republican field in terms of piercing the support that Trump has illustrated? Now for going on, it's got to be 6 or 7 months. In a very real sense, his campaign got underway, Scott, perhaps 6 or 8 days prior to his visit to the Tribune editorial board.
Yes.
Which has to have been in June.
So it's your doing.
Yeah, it's our fault.
So
launched here.
Are you surprised?
At 435 North Michigan.
The Republican field hasn't done better with Trump?
I'm not, in part because of what's been said about him sucking the air out of the room. And the other Republican candidates haven't been forceful in their views to break through that clutter. You have, you know, two senators who are, you know, one is sort of indistinguishable from the other in many cases. The younger voters may be finding them appealing. And then a whole wide range of others. So we'll have to see what happens next. But so far, nobody's broken through.
Scott's point is
That's Sarah Beardsley, and that was Joe Morris. And we've also heard from Scott Stantis. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. The program is Beyond the Beltway. We're glad you're here, and we'll be back right after these words.
Excuse me, Chad. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
The beauty of Amlink's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown is a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Evening, if it's Sunday evening and it's beyond the Beltway, my name's Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. He's taking a well-deserved evening off. We hope you had a great holiday weekend, and we're very happy to be a part of it this evening with our great panel. We've got Democrat Sarah Beardsley, Republican Joe Morris, and Chicago Tribune political, I was going to say columnist. You are kind of a columnist.
Kinda.
You do visual columns.
Commentator. That
it's
sounds...
Scott Stantis, the political cartoonist for the Chicago Tribune. So we're talking about Trump, and we're talking about what happened in 2015. How many, show of hands, how many of us thought that Trump was just getting into this as another vanity thing?
Of course. Yeah. Everything he does is driven by vanity.
We thought it was all a vanity thing, and that wouldn't really
still
last.
Is.
we are taking phone calls tonight. We've got Pam in Chicago who's listening to us at beyondthebeltway.com. Pam, your bottom line point for the panel, please.
Trump is connecting with people viscerally, and the Republican electorate is disgusted with what elected Republicans have been doing and that they continue to do. And as long as he taps on emotions, I think he's going to surprise everybody, and he may very well go all the way.
Terrific, Pam. Thank you very much for joining the program.
Pam makes a good point. There's a soft underbelly of the Republican field, which is the disappointment that many voters have in keeping a check on Mr. Obama and his enthusiasms. They keep electing Republican congresses to kind of rein in Mr. Obama, and they seem to be inefficacious.
Right. So, Scott Stantis, why are they inefficacious?
Well, I'll have to look that up, and we'll do that on the break. But Joe's point is well taken. And I think Democrats, but you mentioned earlier before the break, Democrats also have to be loving this candidacy. And if you saw the last...
Let's ask Sarah. Are you loving this candidacy?
Except for having to listen to him. I think he makes a fantastic counterpoint to someone who actually has depth and skill and competency.
Who's that?
Bernie Sanders.
Bernie Sanders? Okay.
Well, back
to the inefficaciousness.
The Democratic debate, the last one, yeah, which they hit, I think it was on Sunday morning at 3 a.m. or something.
Yeah.
Because Lord knows they don't want their candidate to
it
be
seen. It was broadcast
seen.
In Croatia at primetime.
Yes. It was. I think it was on Guam TV.
Yeah.
Anyway, they talked more about Donald Trump than they talked about each other or any real policies that they were trying to project. And it was fascinating to me. So this is, again, another example of how this one person has sucked all the air.
Okay,
out of the
but
room.
Look, I want to get to this point from Pam to Joe and now to us. And that is, there are a lot of Republicans who are really disappointed that they were told, elect a Republican House, we'll straighten this out. They did. Nothing seemed to change. Then they were told, no, you got to now elect a Republican Senate. We'll straighten this whole thing out. They did, and they still can't. Then they said, we got to get rid of Boehner. They got rid of Boehner, and Ryan passes this budget, yeah, which apparently came right from Boehner. I mean, Sarah, what is it that we don't understand about being in the minority?
Are Republicans in the minority?
No, we're now in the majority, and we're still acting like we're in the minority.
I think there's an element of not being able to compromise with one another, either within the Republican Party, Joe, or across the aisle.
So, example, Planned Parenthood funding. Let's just say.
For example, McCain and the other more moderate Republican faction of the party are horrified at the choices, not just the one we've been talking about, but the other members of the Tea Party who are running. There's a significant schism within the Republican Party.
I don't think that's serious a schism. I think if they felt that they could succeed in making policy decisions, they would make them. There is this remarkable fear that paralyzes Republicans, it seems, on the Hill these days, that if they take a policy stance and it results in a conflict with the executive branch, it shuts down the government or something, inevitably it will be the Republicans who are blamed, whatever the consequence is. So that Mr. Obama has sketched out, mapped out an approach to dealing with Congress that turns out to be highly efficacious from his point of view, which is a no-compromise point of view. There will be no Republican participation in designing health care reform. There will be no Republican participation in designing trade policy and so forth. So the Republicans are kept on the outside. There's no opportunity to compromise. And this, by the way, is another feature of Obamaism that Donald Trump has seized on in his approach to public policy. He's a no-compromise kind of guy. Elect me and there will be no compromise with fools and idiots.
Is that where the budget came from? Is that where the recent spending budget that Speaker Ryan endorsed
and
passed?
It was in the calculations of Republicans, I think, in the back rooms. The most Republicans could achieve without garnering an Obama veto. And an Obama veto was a real fear because they felt that if there was a collapse of the operation of government by failure of appropriations, by the lack of appropriations, Republicans and not the vetoer would take the heat for it.
But isn't this – I mean, it's so frustrating because Republicans I expect them to act like crazy me, Republicans. And in this spending bill, it was the most egregious thing I think they've passed in a decade. They went along with every spending request from the White House. $600 billion in tax cuts without any tangible or realistic or even meaningful cuts in spending. This, to me, is about as anti-Republican as you can possibly get.
You don't have to be a Tea Partier to find an obnoxious package. And I think that the Trump enthusiasm is tapping into that frustration.
Into that frustration in the Republican Party, is it also reaching outside? Have we seen in 2015 Trump and his sort of, you know, brand of braggadocio or whatever it is, have we seen that bring folks into the Republican world who may not have been there, say, 4 years ago or 8 years ago?
I think that seriously has to be Trump's only hope at winning a nomination or an election. That is to bring in new, you know, Trump Republicans and the model of Reagan Democrats. I think it's unlikely to be successful. You want to talk about predictions in the second hour, but I think what we consistently see in the polls is there is a ceiling on Trump's popularity and support, as well as a floor. And I think that probably explains another dimension of this curious phenomenon, which is why there is some level of relaxation about the opposing Republican candidates. If I were one of them, I'd be very frustrated, as Scott points out. They're having a fabulous debate about really important topics, trade policy, immigration, and so forth. Really important things.
National security. What to do with ISIS. Our relationship with the Arab world, our relationship with the Muslim world.
And the extent to which boots on the ground versus other approaches to the applications of power are appropriate or make sense.
Trump has contributed almost nothing to those. Maybe one to the tax policy. Maybe that's about
– yeah. But he's drawn a curtain in front of the eyes of the American people and seeing and listening to the rest of that debate. It has been, as Scott points out, a fabulous debate.
It's a Charlie Sheen approach to foreign policy. Winning.
Right. It's a celebrity culture that we're experiencing.
Right.
And there are several – celebrities right now in the Republican Party, Donald Trump being the largest, most talked about one. You could argue that Carly Fiorina is the second, a business celebrity of sorts, not always positively viewed for her past track record. But in celebrity, you can be famous for being famous. You don't have to be famous or well-known or talked about for what you've done, what stands you've taken, any of your accomplishments.
Right. I want to sort of take a look in the second half hour at the Democrats and what's been going on with Hillary. But just in our closing few minutes here, I want to look. We've seen Jeb Bush fall on his face. We've seen Marco Rubio and Ted Cruz begin to generate some interest. Ben Carson had interest and sort of lost it when things focused on terrorism and international relations and foreign policy and military policy. What can we say about these otherwise interesting candidates that they seem to have failed to capture much of an imagination?
In the emotional sweepstakes department, Jeb Bush is an excellent counterpoint to Donald Trump here. He has been so bland in contradistinction to Trump's high-intensity emotion. There is some appetite in the American people for somebody who cuts through the fog and simply says, this is right and that is wrong. Mr. Reagan himself captured that very neatly back in 1980 when he said, what's my foreign policy? We win, they lose. There is Soren Kierkegaard's line, purity of heart is to will one thing. You know, a clear vision is something that's very attractive to people. Somebody who's a genuine conviction politician, as Mr. Reagan was, as Mr. Trump is not, is very attractive on those grounds. But Mr. Trump projects a certainness, a sure-footedness that comes from the persona that we've become accustomed to over 10 years of his personality on television. You're fired, right. He will say. Well, very well. We want somebody in the White House who will point at the people running the not-for-profit programs at the Internal Revenue Service and say, you're fired. If that's the dream, it explains part of Trump's popularity for sure.
Scott, you've seen a lot of these folks come through the Tribune editorial boardroom. What's your opinion of this of the rest of the field out there?
I think they're terrific. I happen to be very interested and still on the fence, but looking at Marco Rubio and he's been playing an interesting game this campaign. The expectation is that the Trump thing would pop, the Trump balloon would pop, and that he'd be standing there, and he's still presenting himself as above the fray. He hasn't attacked any of the other candidates. You have Cruz, who's brilliant and does say the things you say that need to be said, but again, nobody hears them. And Cruz is being ostracized in the press as a Tea Partier and a crazy man and stupid.
He's unlikable.
I think Cruz also proves the point that Sarah was making about the internal divisions of the Republican Party, because there are fellow Republican senators, some of whom have told me personally, if Ted Cruz gets anywhere near this thing, I'm going to go fishing for
absolutely.
I mean, are you seeing
government is compromise. Government is a collaboration and building consensus where you need it, where you have to have support. People don't like to hear that, but it's true. They like the it's my way or the highway George Bushism or the Donald Trump no consensus.
Mr. Obama has made a career out of not compromising. and that's the successful model, I'm afraid, that's leading too many Republicans down the primrose path. But Cruz is – Sarah's right. And Scott is right. Cruz's approach to this problem of Americans who are dissatisfied with the inefficaciousness of the Republican opposition was to go on the attack, the personal attack, against the leaders of his own party in his own chamber and the leaders of his party across the Hill, the Capitol.
That is Joe Morris, former high official of the Reagan administration. We've also got Sarah Beardsley, a Democratic activist here in Chicago, and Scott Stantis, the political cartoonist of the Chicago Tribune. It's Beyond the Beltway, and I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont, back after these words.
This is Larry King at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Tonight, we've got a special guest for you to meet. What do you like to do as a kid?
I like to play baseball. I like to watch television.
What was your favorite sports team?
Sports team growing up was the St. Louis Cardinals.
What was your favorite vacation?
I think the vacation we went to New York City to the World's Fair, see Yankee Stadium.
Who was your childhood hero?
Childhood hero, probably Hopalong Cassidy.
What was your biggest fear growing up?
My biggest fear probably was that I would irritate my father.
What's the silliest thing you've ever done?
Irritated my father.
Give the gift of Larry King. Order your gift certificate now at museum.tv. That's museum.tv.
Good evening across the country. Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Thanks for joining us. It's Beyond the Beltway. Joining us tonight here around the table with your phone calls, Sarah Beardsley, Democrat here in Chicago, Scott Stantis, political cartoonist at the Chicago Tribune, and Joe Morris, longtime Republican activist. Our phone-in number, 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. We are going to get to the Democrats, but Mark in Monterey, California, is listening to us on the great KION. One can only imagine the beauty surrounding Mark as the sun sets on the Pacific Ocean, and he's somewhere nestled next to the 17-mile drive in Monterey. Mark, join us and tell us your bottom line point about Donald Trump.
Well, I think the thing that Trump really understands is how to negotiate, and he had a really apt critique of the Republicans recently where leadership said they would not shut down the government. Now, whether or not you agree with shutting down the government or not, saying that you're not going to do something, you've given up all of your negotiating ability with the other side. And how the Republican leadership doesn't understand that they handicap themselves when they do that, is beyond me. And you know, Trump pointed that out. He said, I would never say something like that because now you have no point to negotiate from. Why should the president give you anything?
Mark, thank you very much for joining us. Joe Morris, back to you real quick before we get to the Democrats. Why do the Republicans seem not to understand the prerogatives of being in the majority in Congress?
They weren't listening when John Kennedy said, do not negotiate out of fear, but never fear to negotiate. They're caught between the fear of failing in negotiation, being seen to be compromisers and tainting themselves, and being blamed if there is not achieved some kind of result. So at the end of the day, caller's exactly right. Their fear handcuffs them.
Now, Sarah, you're a strategic analyst or strategic consultant for a big consulting company, which we won't mention just so you don't get in trouble. But what do you tell your clients about the importance of leverage in negotiating?
I always say that he who sets the first term has the power. First offer on the table really sets the tone of the negotiation. There's something in us that I think for most of us, we tend to want to compromise and find a way to bring two sides together. And so in that sense, I agree with the caller that the Republicans lost some of that leverage. Why that is, I don't know. Maybe, Joe, it's such an unfamiliar environment to be in to have both House and Senate majorities.
Mm-hmm.
It hasn't happened in a while. Perhaps it's nothing
endemic in being a Republican. On my watch, when I worked for President Reagan, he shut down the government cheerfully seven times. Seven times he acted to veto appropriations bills, knowing that the cost was going to be a government shutdown. We emerged a winner each time. Now perhaps there is some dynamic between the difference between being in charge of the executive branch and being in charge of the Hill that gives a competitive advantage in the media to the president under such circumstances. But President Reagan would never give up the threat of a veto or the threat of shutting down the government as leverage to work by his lights was a successful compromise with the Hill.
Scott Stantis, your last comment on the Republicans and how they've been behaving in 15 before you get to the Democrats in 15.
They're weak and they capitulate for a very sad reason. They don't want to be perceived as the meanies anymore. You know, the press, frankly, the Democratic Party has been very successful at framing Republicans as mean. They hate and brutal. And so how do you do that? Well, you compromise with the president on issues that are at the core of your agenda, and you turn your back on that agenda. And it's a sad comment, frankly.
Well, let's talk about the Democrat agenda, and let's talk about what's been going on in 2015 on the Democratic side. Sarah, did you think this week in 2014 that the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination, Hillary Clinton, would be under FBI criminal investigation for how she was dealing with her emails and her servers while she was Secretary of State by, you know, 1 year hence? Did you think Christmas to New Year's last year that you would be here right now?
I didn't foresee that. That was not on my list of predictions for 2015. However, given the keen interest in bringing down every Clinton, by many people, I won't presume to name who they are, but there's a pretty substantial chance that anything that can be found or, pardon the expression, trumped up will be.
And do you think that speaks to any lack of preparation or any overconfidence on Hillary's part as she was entering 2015, a prelude to what she knew would be her, you know, real shot at the presidency?
Yeah, I think it's a good question. You know, with people who are so competent, sometimes they are maligned in a way that people think that they are very thoughtful and planful in what they do. To me, it was more naivete than it was lack of planning.
Should we elect someone who's naive?
Sure. We've done so. We've done so throughout our history, of course.
Really?
Everybody has blind spots, of course.
Really?
Absolutely.
Our phone number is 800-723-8289, 800-723-8289. The next half hour, we're going to be talking about Democrats. Joe, should we elect somebody who is naive?
The resilience of Mrs. Clinton and the Clintons generally has got to be one of the headline stories of 2015. I am having a brain freeze here. I can't think of the name of the NBC political reporter who 8 years ago was feeling a tingle up his leg.
That was Chris Matthews. Chris Matthews. MSNBC.
Thank you. Chris Matthews, who was so thrilled that the Obama candidacy, if it meant nothing else, meant death, the removal from the national scene of the Clintons.
Yes, right.
And that was the attitude of so many in the Democratic Party and the left of the mainstream media. Just 8 short years ago, it is.
Well, including, just by the way, our ambassador to the United Nations, Do you remember Samantha Power and her emails about the witch is dead and, you know, we don't have to worry about Hillary anymore? I mean, she was
exactly. I mean, it was an across the board pandemic view among so many Democrats, and it's astonishing that 8 years on, Mrs. Clinton seems to be the best that the Democrats can do, and is so popular. To the contrast between the Democratic debates, presidential candidate debates, and the Republican presidential candidate debates, if you filter out the Trump factor, is astonishing. As interesting as the debates among the non-Trump candidates on the Republican side have been, the Democratic debates have been absolutely cipher debates. Bernie Sanders has a real opportunity, for example, at the present moment, to be a true conviction politician. He could be out there laying out chapter and verse of a very principled, value-laden, thoughtful, coherent, systematic approach to the kind of socialism
about, to which he's dedicated his life.
To which has been the focus of his life,
right.
Staying out of the Democratic Party as an institutional matter in Vermont in order to have the freedom and the purity with which to pursue this vision, and to which he's given next to no voice at all. It's been an extraordinarily inarticulate candidacy on Bernie Sanders' part, one of the stunners of 2015.
Although one that seems to be connecting with millennials who are very much behind his messaging, and they see that conviction politics in a way that's speaking very truthfully to them.
Are they seeing that at the expense of Hillary Clinton?
Yes.
Do you think they will go in? Do you think young folks will be reading tea leaves after Iowa and New Hampshire that say the young voters have gone for Bernie and the middle-aged and older voters are going for Hillary?
I think that's what's happening in the polls. You're seeing that in the anecdotal conversations I've been a part of. That's absolutely the case.
All right. 2016 will be next hour, but sorry for that.
One of the most telling moments of my career in 2015 was I was speaking to a group of interns, all 25 and younger. And I, at the end, they asked me a bunch of questions. I said, now it's my turn to ask you questions. And I said, how many of you are Democrats? All the hands go up. How many of you are Republicans? Not a hand went up. I went, okay, fine. How many of you are going to vote for Hillary? This is about 30 interns. One hand goes up. How many of you are going to vote for Bernie? 29 of them go shooting up.
Seriously.
Enthusiastically, I thought, she has a problem. You know, whether or not how the math works out on this, I'm not entirely sure. And I know it's allegorical, but it was still a telling moment. I was stunned.
Right.
I was genuinely stunned.
Well, are you yearning for more debate on the Democratic side? Not just more debates, but I mean, Joe says the debates are sort of, not to say vapid, but maybe
not anymore. I mean, if not Bernie something. Sanders apologizes to Hillary one more time, I mean, I'm going to not vote for. Well, I wouldn't vote for him anyway.
I think vapid's right.
You think vapid is right?
Put your finger on the word vapid. That's an appropriate characterization.
Well, wait, we're also forgetting the third guy in the race still, the shirtless guy. That's the only way I know.
Martin O'Malley, the one-time governor of Maryland.
Who takes his shirt off more than Putin.
I'm wondering.
That's hard to do.
I know. It really is. I'm surprised he hasn't done it during the debate. Just
all right. So, and why is he still
awesome.
There? I mean, all kidding aside, with Lindsey Graham and there are other folks wandering around on the Republican side who are still there. Why is
Lindsey Graham dropped out?
I know he did. Thank God. But there are these wanderers out there who don't seem to get the message, and maybe they're waiting for Iowa or something. But really, what is going on with Martin O'Malley? Any idea? You're the Democrat.
No idea.
I mean,
sorry. Well,
what's the cost? I mean, the guy's making a living. He's funded. He's funded enough to be in the campaign, such as it is. It's a very low intensity campaign for all of them, isn't it? At this point.
Mm-hmm.
What is the cost to Martin O'Malley?
And it positions him for punditry for MSNBC or CNN.
Cabinet or something like that. Sure. But in terms of 2000...
We're not talking about 2016 yet, but amazing things could happen at a national convention.
Well, so 2015, something did happen, and that is that Joe Biden, after giving out almost every... It was a tragic year with the loss of his son and all that portends. Joe Biden left. A quick word... What did it mean to the Democrats that Joe Biden decided not to get in?
I think it showed a tremendous depth of character on his part and understanding of what his candidacy would mean to the field and to their ability to win. I mean, that's an example of someone who's putting the party and perhaps even the country ahead of his own objectives and ambitions.
Yeah, I think that... A, the death of his son, and two, he did view the Hillary campaign spiraling in the drain and could have had an opportunity. But I think you have to want that office more than you want anything in the whole wide world. And I don't think he had it anymore. 71 years old.
I think that the wisdom on the Democratic Party was that the seat was not winnable. The presidency was not winnable. Absent the Trump factor, he didn't think he could win.
It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Thank
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
Sunday night means Beyond the Beltway. Normally it means Bruce Dumont. Tonight, Chris Roebling. Bruce taking a well-deserved evening off. Thanks for joining us. We asked the panel to come up with their lists of top stories in 2015. And so let's get to those here. And we'll start with Sarah Beardsley. Your top story, Sarah, your top five stories for 2015.
Top five all in a row. Okay, the first has to be the increase in violence, both domestic and international terrorism and gun violence that we've seen in this country and globally. Second is the refugee crisis that is flooding half of the world with people that are displaced from their homes due to more violence. The climate change initiative that occurred in Paris was fantastic. And closer to home here in the U.S., the bubbling up of what has always been difficult race relations in this country. And then lastly, business fraud. We've seen it with FIFA. We've seen it with Volkswagen. We've seen it with Keurig Pharmaceuticals. Some very big stories in that front this year.
Well, it's just presidential politics didn't even get up there.
I know. We've covered it. That's it. I knew by this time it would be one and done.
All right. Scott Stantis, your list.
My list. Growth of ISIS, of course, is number one. Trump was number two. We've gone through that. Number three is police shootings, and there seems to be a systemic national problem, and we need to address that in policing practices in the United States. Number four is Putin and Russia's reascension, if that's a word. If it's not, it is now. Back into superpower stature. His moves into Syria, his moves into, of course, Georgia, and now into the Crimea. As a Lithuanian American, I'm concerned about now what he's going to do with the Baltics. He's made some forays into there. And lastly, the death of newspapers, which is very important to me. I think for the first time in our lifetimes, first time in a century and a half, we're going to see communities lose their newspaper altogether. And that's a sad thing. It's sad for democracy. It's obviously sad for a citizen and for having an informed citizenry.
Hmm. Joe Morris.
My list leads off with the Iranian nuclear deal, which I think has tremendous portents for the future, and the future will tell us whether the deal turns out to be a good deal or a very, very bad deal. I fear the worst. I hope for the best. The second most important issue, I think, development of the year, was violations by Iran already of that deal in a whole host of fronts, including violations of the prohibitions on testing delivery systems such as intercontinental ballistic missiles. I think the third most important issue is closely related to Scott's observations about Russia is the rise of Chinese aggressiveness, particularly territorial claims in the Pacific, the mm-hmm. creation of new land in order to anchor those claims. I agree that the problems of violence at home in America in particular are important, and an interesting fillip in that, a twist on it, is the greater visibility of both police incompetence and police corruption that has always been a soft underbelly of the management of urban politics in America.
I go ahead.
And the fifth is completely off the political radar. It is the announcement by the Roman Catholic Church of a very thoughtful, and to go back to a word with which we opened the program when we were talking of all things Donald Trump, a nuanced understanding of some important theological concepts. The church just a week or two ago issued the Sacred Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith a position statement. Actually, no, it's the Congregation for Christian Unity, of which a subset is relations with the Jews. That congregation issued a very thoughtful paper, mischaracterized by the media as an abjuration by the church of attempts to convert Jews to Christianity, in which the church wrestles with two doctrinal points that are in absolute contradiction with each other. One is the proposition that the church teaches from its beginnings that the only path to salvation is through the person of Jesus Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And the second proposition, which the church has held from the beginning, is the validity of the Jewish covenant, the covenant between the Jewish people and God. How can both of those things be true at the same time? They would appear to be self-contradictory. And the church says it is the position of the church that we hold both of those propositions to be true. The contradiction notwithstanding, the resolution of that contradiction is one of those fundamental mysteries to which only God knows the answer. That is a really important statement about Jewish-Christian relations that will reverberate not just through this year but through the centuries.
I want to add, especially in the year running up to the 500th anniversary of the Reformation, the start of the Reformation with Luther.
Which is what, just 2 years away?
Just 2 years away, coming up October 30th, 2016 or 17.
And we're coming up also on the 2000th anniversary of the Nicene Creed, aren't we?
Yeah, so there are a lot of big anniversaries coming up. But I want to go back to this something that none of you raised, and that is Europe dissolving? Is Europe today weaker than what it was a year ago? Are we looking at a weaker political institution, not just starting the year in Greece and ending the year in Paris, but and therefore you've got the monetary issue and then you've got all of the political and security issues at the back end? What do we think is the future of Europe?
You're absolutely right. And the issue is the weakness, the danger of the collapse of Europe, greater perhaps of greater consequence than the disappearance of newspapers, perhaps not. but this is the story here is not migration of populations from the Middle East that may be diluting European population or diluting European culture. It is a story of self-implosion that's been developing over decades.
Sarah, go ahead.
I was just going to jump in and say, are we talking about the implosion of Europe, of the EU,
yes,
or are we talking about European states? Because European states seem certainly stronger than the United States currently.
Well, I
think they're strong. I think as states, they're very strong. And they're more welcoming of refugees and have a broader social policy as a generalization than our own United States does. I was in Spain in September and saw lots of signs welcoming Syrian refugees and those from other countries. So, I mean, the currency may not be as strong as it needs to be, the euro, that is. And some of the resolution for Greece has been great. But I would say that each European state is doing fine unto itself, notwithstanding the violence that's been occurring in many of those countries.
Scott?
Well, I think that the immigration issue is going to be a big issue. It's going to dilute the current, or as we perceive, European culture. But as European states, Germany, France, and the UK peripherally have been much stronger than the United States on international affairs.
That is Scott Stantis, preceded immediately by Sarah Beardsley, and earlier by Joe Morris. My name is Chris Roebling. I'm sitting in for Bruce Dumont. It's great to be with you. Thanks for joining us this evening. And we're going to be back after some words with more of Beyond the Beltway.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton Los Angeles Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
The beauty of Amling's interior landscape is that we can come in, work with your budget, and create a fit that makes sense for your facility at that time. Our goal is to create foliage designs that not only look incredible the day we put them in, but you can go back 2 years later and it is still maintained and has grown as a perfect fit for that customer's environment.
Call Amlings now at 888-880-TREE.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
Excuse me, Chet. Here is a flash from the Associated Press, Dateline Dallas. Two priests who were with President Kennedy say he is dead of bullet wounds.
It was a moment that defined American history. But what really happened in Dallas that day? And does that tragedy lead back to Chicago? A new play, Assassination Theater, answers that question. Now at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. For tickets, go to assassinationtheater.com.
Good evening, everybody. It's Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. He's taking the night off, and this is Beyond the Beltway. We're joined by a terrific panel tonight. Joe Morris is our Republican, our Democrat, Sarah Beardsley, and Scott Stantis, our representative of the media. Now, we closed the last hour chatting about your view of the top stories, and this hour we want to talk more about 2016. We've got a couple of things to cover, but I asked you for predictions. So since we closed the last hour with your top stories, let's start this hour with your predictions for 2016. Joe, why don't you go first?
You want all five or just...
I want all five.
All five. All right.
Let's put it on the table and then we'll talk about it.
Prediction number one, there will be a dark horse candidacy emerging at the Democratic National Convention. Remember, the rules and the law permit a party to nominate someone who's not been in the primaries or the caucuses. That could happen. Mm-hmm. I predict that there will be a surge for Elizabeth Warren at the Democratic National Convention. That is Hillary Clinton's biggest fear, and the biggest fear is that the tepid, vapid Bernie Sanders campaign has been a stalking horse for Elizabeth Warren. All of those millennials whom Sarah has seen get excited by Bernie Sanders will be surging for Elizabeth Warren. I predict we will see some effort along those lines. Prediction number two, if, in fact, Hillary Clinton becomes the nominee of the Democratic Party and the Republican nominee is not Donald Trump, no matter who the Republican nominee is, if not Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton will lose. Third, I think that the Federal Reserve System, the Board of Governors, and the Open Market Committee will not raise interest rates further in 2016, having just raised interest rates at the end of 2015.
The first time in 9 years, 7 years?
Just last week, yes, for the first time in many years. I predict that the United Kingdom will vote by a very, very, very narrow margin in a referendum to withdraw from the European Union, at least the economic side of the European Union. There will be a very cumbersome and complex and very strained process of trying to renegotiate relations between the United Kingdom and the European Union on political and